Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, today on Exploring the Wine Glass, I sit down with several of my wine-loving friends and we discuss a very scary topic. One that is rather hard to believe is actually happening, but you know, they say numbers don't lie. There has been a decline in the consumption of wine throughout 2019, and the trend seems to be continuing into 2020. There are many beliefs as to why this downfall is occurring, and like many things in today's world, it is blamed on those darn millennials. Do they really have that much power? What about this generation is causing the wine industry to stop and take notice and quite honestly begin to quake in their shoes? I am not willing to rule them out, but I am also not so inclined to think that this trend is based solely on them. There has to be more to it, and I bring these additional topics up to my panel to get their opinions. And for fun, don't forget, we always end this episode with a riddle. Will you be able to solve it before they do? Sláinte. Hey everybody, welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass, and tonight we are doing a wine writer's wrap-up. And what our topic is tonight is a very big or popular topic that's hitting every darn newspaper there is and every newscast there is, and no matter what you turn to, it's in there, is what is happening to the wine consumption in 2019 and how it's decreasing even more in 2020. So a few wine writers got together with me, and we're going to introduce them right now, and we're going to get into why wine consumption is lowering. So, Maria, how about you first?
All right. Hi, I'm Maria Ferraro-Bierski. My website is wineandcheesefriday.com, and I write all about wines, cheeses, and anything you can see that's related to them. Tonight I'm in Costa Rica.
Yay! And John?
Hi, I'm John Taylor. I've been a wine sales and marketing professional in Napa Valley for the past 10 years, and I am the author of Pairs with Life, which is a blog at www.pairswithlife.net.
Debbie?
I'm Debbie Quindo. I blog and write under HudsonValleyWineGoddess.com. I'm also author of Tapping the Hudson Valley, Day Trips and Weekend Itineraries, Visiting the Hudson Valley Wine Region. And I am a partner in a restaurant in Storm Harbor, New Jersey called Kitchen 330.
And I am your host, Lori. I am a UC Davis and a WSET Level 2 graduate. And my husband and I own Dracena Wines, which is a boutique winery in Paso Robles, focusing on Cabernet Franc. So thank you everybody for joining on this topic. And
Wait. Lori, we both forgot about Wine for Bet Street.
And we forgot about Wine for Bet Street.
Lori and I host Wine for Bet Street the third Monday of the month. It's a wine education program taking you through the Wine for Bet one letter at a time.
There you go. Ditto. All right. So I'm sure everybody has seen in the newspapers, online, everything. You know, I get Google alerts for wine every day, and every day there are like 10 different articles about how wine consumption is decreasing and what is the reason behind it. So I have a few. I've read the articles and I copied down a few of what they say are the reasons, and I just thought we would discuss them and see what you think. And I'm going to start off with the number one, those darn millennials, okay? The poor millennials, they honestly are being blamed for everything that's wrong with our world today. So why not add wine consumption dropping? So in an article on January 19th, they say that wine sales slow as millennials drink seltzer. So this was kind of a combination reasoning. So not only millennials are to blame, but then seltzer is to blame. So what do you guys think? Let's start with millennials first, and then we'll yell at the seltzers. So what do you guys think about millennials causing the downfall of wine?
I will say, having a child that's a millennial, she's big into the seltzer, and having a restaurant, I do see a lot of, it's a BYO because New Jersey laws, yada, yada, yada. A lot of people do come in with the seltzers. But when I was out tonight, you know, I talked about the discussion here tonight. And, you know, seltzers, I mean, you can get a liter of club soda, a bottle of grapefruit vodka, whoosh, and you got yourself a drink.
You got yourself a party.
But the millennials, they're going for that. I mean, I see it with my daughter.
I think there's a lot of it is a matter of choice. They just have so many more choices than, say, my generation did when we first started drinking. You know, when I first started drinking, there was, what, four different kinds of beer, and there was maybe California coolers on the wine cooler front, and then, you know, really not even that many brands of wine that were out there. Millennials now have just this infinite number of choices between seltzers and craft beers and wines and coolers and now cannabis. So what that ends up with is that, not that they don't particularly have an affinity for something, or they're not developing this brand loyalty, but they're just like, hey, that was good, I like trying it, now I'm going to try this other thing and see if I like that. And so there's, by having so many choices to choose from, they're just not going to necessarily choose wine. And I'll make one other point to that too. Wine is expensive compared to some of these other choices. Millennials are going to be the first generation that do not have the same income that their parents have, or that the generation before them has. And so they're going to have to make choices that are cheaper. And this will take $20 bottles of wine, pretty much, and everything above, out of the picture.
I don't know if I agree with that, knowing what my kids make. And my kids, I will tell you, they are 25 and 27. And they make more money than I made at that age. And what was I drinking at that age? Beer and vodka. But it's a different society now. You know, and I don't think there is, for what you said, John, there is no brand loyalty to them. Right. So they'll jump whatever the next thing is that overdeps into it.
Well, statistics are showing that John is right, that the millennials are making less money, and it has, you know, they're making everything smaller. You know, they are the people who do the tiny houses, all of that type of thing, but they are the. I guess there are jobs out there for them that they can make a lot of money, but overall the general population, statistics are showing that they are not making as much. Maybe it has to do that they move around, I don't know, but
wow, because I know a couple that I made at the age of 40 what my son is making now.
Well, good for him.
I get it. I live in San Francisco, so our millennials are millionaires.
Yeah.
So I think it's a little different in certain pockets, you know, in different markets. But generally speaking,
right?
I think those numbers play out.
Maria,
I was going to say, with the price per bottle, I mean, there are wines under $20 a bottle. So I mean, yes, if we're saying we'll count the wines over 20 out, there's a lot of wine under 20, and I can't say this for sure, but if they're a millennial, that means they're younger and that they just started drinking, most likely. So they're probably not all that refined that they're going to say, oh, I have to have a wine over $20. So, I mean, they could be trying the $15 a bottle per wine, which, I mean, would make the spend less if you're looking at what the spend is from everybody, that if they're only spending $15 and other people are usually spending $45, like, yeah, those numbers are going to balance that they're spending less, but they could still be trying those. The other thing I was going to say about the cost is that one of the things I was reading about was the new, if you will, wine in a can industry, and that the millennials like those because it's not as much of a commitment. So it's still wine. It's just in a can, and it would be $8 or $10 or whatever, and they could try it that way. So, I mean, I don't know. Both of those would be spending a small amount on wine, but it could still be them spending money on wine.
There's nothing wrong with, you know, $10 bottles of wine.
Right, but when you're looking at when the reports are recording the wine consumption, a large portion of it is how much dollars are going towards wine.
Okay.
So that would have
versus seltzer versus beer versus hard liquor.
Right. I think going back to what millennials are, I just think that they like experiences. It's no longer, you know, they're not getting married. They're not, you know, forming a nest egg. They're about living in the moment. And I think, like what John said, they try this and, okay, that was good. And then they move on to something else. And they're like, oh, this is good. And they move on to something else. There's not the, you know, the let's learn about this and let's, you know, take this to heart and be what we deal with on a daily basis, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Silence.
We need to get a paper over in here and ask them.
I didn't hear what you said, John.
Oh, I need to get my son in here and ask him as well.
Oh.
I think he would kind of agree with the notion of there's just so much to try.
Right.
He loves craft beer, and he's always talking about a new and different one. You know, and that's kind of where I came up with the brand loyalty thing is that it's never the same thing. He likes beer. I think he's settled on beer, but he's always trying a different one.
Right. So there,
I kind of have to agree with you because my son goes to different breweries every weekend or distilleries or wineries. Like, so
there's an app called Untappd, and it's basically Facebook for beer lovers. Is what
there's
it is.
Brewery. My son got me on brewery.
Brew. Okay. So
yeah.
You check in what beer you drink, right?
Yeah.
And I'm very much in that same realm, John. Like that. When Mike and I go out to have a beer, you know, we'll pull up the app and say, "Oh, I've had that already. Nope, I'm going to have this one." You know, so even if I'm rating it 5 stars or, you know, 4.5 stars, which meant I loved it, I'm still looking for a different taste. I'm still looking for a different experience. And I am sure not a millennial.
Because when you take a look at wine and the cost of wine, if you're going to start spending $40 or above on a bottle of wine, chances are you're going to order that same bottle again because you know that you're going to get your $40, $50, $100 worth, right? You're very reticent to try a new $100 bottle of wine that you've never heard of, say, in a restaurant. But with beer and with seltzer, they're all within the same price range. You don't get to $100 bottles of seltzer. You don't get to $50 or even $20 bottles of seltzer. Rarely you get to a $20 bottle of beer. So you have this freedom to explore everything, knowing that you have little to lose.
So in this article from the Hutchinson Leader, which I have no idea where that is, the other thing that they're blaming saying that the millennials are removing themselves from wine is because the trend for them includes more demand for low-calorie, low-carbohydrate products. And that's what brings in these seltzers and
definitely not beer, but brings in the seltzers. And that the seltzer category, spirits and cocktails, that hard seltzer sales represent, in their words, the juggernaut, sales have increased by more than 200% in the past year for seltzer. And everybody's making it now. Freaking Bud Light now has a seltzer.
I know, I saw that.
I will never try it.
I don't think I've even tried one of the seltzers. I've seen them. I've heard about them. I don't think I've ever tried. And I like seltzer water, like, but I don't know. It's just not something that I'm like, ooh, liquor. Like, I'll just drink seltzer that's seltzer. I don't need it to be a liquor. Like.
Yeah. I've only had one. When I was in Nashville with my brother and sister-in-law for my nephew's baseball tournament, all of the moms were drinking seltzers. So I tasted one out of pure curiosity, and I only had one sip.
There was a point that was brought up tonight when we were out that Paul brought up that seltzer, like when I was talked about, we can get a $99 liter bottle of club soda.
$99 club soda?
$0.99 bottle of club soda. And you can get, whatever, say a $10 bottle of grapefruit vodka. And you can mix that together, right, and you've got your seltzer. Paul brought up a point that the seltzer has got grain alcohol in it. I don't know if that's true, but he must have read it.
I think some of them do. I think some of them are malt beverages and others do.
Grain alcohol versus the club soda mixed with grapefruit flavored vodka.
So seltzer has grain alcohol in it?
That's what Paul said.
Huh. And they sell it on the shelf? Like, I can go into, like, ShopRite and buy this?
Yeah.
How does that work?
I've seen them at Safeway.
I'm gonna find a liquor store and go in and get a bottle of seltzer and hard seltzer and look. But he said it's grain alcohol.
Oh! I'm sorry, I missed that whole thing. You're talking actually about the seltzers that they're selling is grain alcohol. I thought you were talking like seltzer water. I was like,
has grain alcohol in it. As opposed to buying a bottle of club soda.
Right, right.
And vodka and mixing it.
Right, right. Well, I don't know. I didn't think it was very good. I thought it was very sweet. And I just didn't like it. And it was like a black cherry or something, which usually anything black cherry I will love. But they were drinking it. We were in bars, and they were ordering it from the bars, and they were paying $10 for a can of the seltzer, you know. But
you know,
meanwhile I was drinking my $5, you know, Miller Lite, you know. But here's some dollar values that this article talked about. They said beer, and I don't know why, but that includes the hard seltzer products, was the biggest seller at $3.06 million, a 2.6% increase from 2018, and all liquor sales totaled $2.19 million, which is a 3.2% increase, while wine sales totaled 973,796, which is a 2% decrease. So that, I mean, you're talking millions versus 900,000. So, but that may go with that if people are buying wine, it's the lower price, like you had said.
Right.
Now, another article that was in Drinks Business actually is saying the opposite. They're saying that yes, the overall cost is down, but the overall volume is down, but the people who are drinking wine are increasing the amount that they're paying for wine. So they're saying that consumers are leaving the lower price segments in favor of better quality offerings. So
say if they're purchasing less because of that, like three big dollar wines instead of eight crappy wines, or
that's basically what I think that's what they're trying to say is that they're, you know, and I guess, you know, if I go out and I buy $100 bottle of wine, I'm probably not taking that bottle home tonight and drinking it. I'm now collecting the wine. And that's what they're saying is the collection of wine is increasing while the lower tier $10 bottle and lower is decreasing. Agree with that? Disagree? Other opinions?
I don't know if I agree with that.
Why?
Based on what I see come in the restaurant. I mean, I see, you know, a lot of $20 and under bottles, which is fine. I mean, you know, price does not dictate the quality.
Right.
Because there's good quality that is $10. I think it goes to what is, you know, think back to when you were a millennial of that age. What were you drinking?
I was drinking more beer than anything else.
I was drinking vodka. So, and, I was drinking vodka and beer then.
John, so, Maria, what were you drinking at that age time?
So are we talking legal drinking age, like 21 and up?
Yeah, so what actually, okay, what's the dates of a millennial now? They're up to
32. Right. Something like that.
So when you were in the upper 20s, what were you drinking?
So in the upper 20s is when I really started to drink wine. And before that, you know, like around legal drinking age was beer for the most part. And, yeah, and then below legal drinking age was wine, because it was like Boone's Farm, you know, it was, you know, you just wanted something sweet because it all tasted awful, right? So, yeah, I the last Nielsen data that I got to look at was about a month ago, and it kind of contradicted that as well, and it said that there was I think it was a 3% slowdown in wine consumption in the $20 to $60 range, and an increase in consumption in the dreaded $5 to $9 range.
Okay.
Yeah. That said, seltzers and we're going through the roof for sure. It's crazy how that's taken off. And I haven't tried it either. I'm saving up to try for it. You know, I'm getting myself prepared for it. But all I can think of is Zima. How can I do anything different than Zima? And Zima was a catastrophe. You know, so.
Right.
Do you think there's too many choices out there for millennials for the promotions that go with it? Like you have the seltzer, and it's the new best thing. So that's what I don't know. I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah, I don't know.
Marie, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Michael.
Okay, I've been listening, but I can't for some reason get on. But but just so we're kind of, everybody gets the right numbers, millennials are 23 to 38.
Oh, hey, 38. Okay.
Yeah, that's the millennial demographics, okay?
Okay.
And just as a comment, I think that both the wine dollars are down, as well as cases are down overall from 2017 to 2019. Both dollars and cases are down. So, and I've got those numbers if you want them, but that's kind of where it's at.
Okay. So, Maria, what were you drinking pre-legal and just after legal and then in your 30s?
Yeah.
Let's see. Pre-legal, it was beer, high school beer. Legal, this may shock you, but I didn't drink from 21 to 25. And then around 30-ish, I shouldn't say I didn't drink. Very little drinking. But then it was really, I got into wine because I was here in California.
That'll do it.
So I spent a lot of time going to Napa, Sonoma, that type of thing.
Maria, yeah, what about you?
I didn't drink really anything until I turned around 30. I don't know. I just didn't. And then I started working at a vineyard right around then, and that's when I really got into wine. So, I mean, wine is really the only thing that I drink, and even now. And it's funny because I go to a bar and I'm like, I don't know, gin and tonic? It's the only drink I've ever heard of. Like, so I really don't drink other things besides wine, but a lot of times I won't get wine in a bar because I think, oh, that's just going to be garbage. So, but yeah, I mean, wine is really the only thing I've ever drank, and I didn't drink, like I said, in my 20s just because I didn't. So I don't know. I mean, I will say I'm around that cusp of the millennial age, a couple years past, but I knew that. I knew that I was on the edge when we were saying like around 30. I was like, I think it's a little higher than that, but I'm not really sure.
Well, I pre-legal was drinking those little Heineken nips because that was the easiest things to get, those 8-packs. And then even through college was all beer. And, you know, we started getting into wine when Mike and I were dating. We would, you know, every time we'd go out, it would be beer. But then when we were having dinner, when he was cooking me dinner as our date night, we would go pick up a bottle of wine. But as much as we're into wine, I would say we're equally into beer. You know, I mean, we take vacations around going to breweries. So, it's pretty high up there. Now, I don't know, this is the drinks business, so I usually expect them to be pretty good. They're saying that the slowdown is attributed to the habits of both baby boomers and millennials. The former, so the baby boomers control 70% of the U.S. discretionary income and half of the net worth of the U.S., but they are moving into retirement and declining in both their numbers and per capita consumption. So they're really kind of blaming the baby boomers on the decrease. That, well, they're declining, so that's not, I guess.
They put all their eggs in one basket?
I think they're saying they're just dying is pretty much what.
Well, They're going,
so
we're dying.
Yeah. So they put it in the biggest basket is what they're saying, meaning that we have the most discretionary income.
Oh, okay.
They were the ones who were most capable of buying your $100 bottles, your $150 bottles, that sort of thing. But as they retire and go on to a fixed income, then that kind of spending goes out the window. You can't really do that anymore. And so
hallelujah. Hallelujah.
But they still want their wine. I mean, this is one of the things that we were really trying to focus on at Pomona was the fact that these boomers, they're going into retirement, they're going on a fixed income, but they are brand conscious. They want their Napa wine. They want their, you know, their Bordeaux's, and they want their Rhone Valley wines. They want those wines that they grew up, you know, enjoying and loving and learning about. Now, how are they going to afford them? How are they going to get them? And I personally think you're going to start seeing wineries really trying to get those prices lower so that their number one consumer can still enjoy the brands. In fact, I heard that Duckhorn is taking advantage of the huge harvest over the past couple of years and is creating a Napa Valley Cabernet that they're trying to retail for $18.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, talking about the baby boomers, one of the things that I was wondering was kind of along the lines of what we just did, how we all said what we were drinking when we were younger, because I've heard that the baby boomers are like the wine people or whatever, but when they were in their 20s and 30s, were they drinking beer and everything? I mean, there's nothing to say that the millennials won't have that grow up shift or whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. As they get older, they get more excited about wine, and then it's no problem anymore because they are the older generation moving through the ranks, and all the wine goes back to being drank. Like maybe it's just a phase or something because they're young.
I agree, but as long as they have the income to make that ascension and maintain it, and because your palate only gets spoiled once you've made that leap. You go from your $5 wine to your $10 to your $15 to your $30, and then you have your $100 bottle of wine. Like, oh my God, I taste the difference. I see what the difference is here. And, you know, and then it's hard to go back from there, but that takes that income to maintain that habit.
And I want to expand on that with back when I was growing up, wine was not on the forefront, you know, so I go to parties, drink beer, go out, drink beer. In college, wine was a jug of Carlo Rossi, you know. So I'm, you know, when you say you haven't had the wine, you know, wine for my generation was not on the forefront like it is today. So in educating, you know, the millennials, they have so many choices. How do they understand, you know, the whole wine aspect to go against, you know, the seltzer, the beer?
Now, here's a question. So, go ahead, Michael.
So the millennials, there's another phenomenon that is overarching, I think, of the whole millennial issue, and that is the millennials are coming across ignorant, and by the way, I have two kids in the same group, so in the millennials, but generally speaking, everything has to get dumbed down. It's the same for the rules of golf, for example. Millennials are not taking up the sport of golf because it's too complicated, and I'm doing this, I know you're on video, but I'm putting parentheses, mm-hmm. It's too complicated. Wine, is too complicated. Many, many things for the millennials, it's too complicated, and we're having to dumb down everything in order to make it more simplistic. And I think that you can only dumb down wine so far. You can only dumb down the essence of golf so far, and it goes on and on and on with other things and other activities. And at some point, you just simply go, you know, guys, either you get it or you don't get it. But I think if we dumb it down so far, this is the whole thing of this canned wine. And again, I don't want to get off a canned wine, but it's not wine. It tastes like, you know, something that you clean up your sewers with. It's not something that's called wine. And so what happens is if the kids get this and people are trying to address the millennials by dumbing down, making it transportable with a can, what they're doing is they're actually hurting themselves, because now these kids have this can of wine. They go, this is horrible. And they're trying to get them as a starter onto that. And now they can simply just flush it all down the toilet and say, we don't want anything to do with this wine industry. So that's my little rant. Sorry.
If we could see you, we would watch you get off your soapbox.
I'm still standing on it.
Yeah, excellent. It's a really good point. And it's going to be interesting to see in the future, you know, the effect that may have on wineries nationwide and worldwide. Because there's, you know, we're in a period of time, like Debbie was saying, you know, yeah, same thing for me. It was, you know, my parents would drink either Blue Nun or Lancer's Rosé, or they'd get their jug of Carlo Rossi, and there weren't many other options past that. And now you have 650 wineries in Napa Valley alone, all of them with their $100 offerings, all vying for that same 1% audience share that's actually buying those. And how's that model going to survive if we aren't bringing up the generation that appreciates those kinds of wine?
So do you think that this, you know how wineries are now leaving the concept of just a tasting, come in, pay your $15, $20, whatever, here's some wine, buy it, get a discount, blah, blah, blah. And now everything is going towards experiences. Right, we have wineries who are doing Jeep tours of the vineyards, and you can, whatever those little scooter things, whatever, you know, where you stand on it, those things, you can tour with those segways, you know, there's segway tours, and there's tasting pairing experiences. Do you think that's going in that direction to try to bring in these people who are wanting, as Michael says, dumb it down? Let's give them an experience so that it's more than just drinking a glass of wine and then expecting to pay that much money.
Who wants to get on their soapbox first?
I'll go.
Okay.
I was going to say, I think that as far as the experience part goes, I've actually worked at a couple wineries, and that was always a tricky discussion that we had, because we had like a vineyard lunch thing that we would do, and okay, you do the tasting, you get your sandwich, you do the tour, you do the whole thing, and the winery owner would get so upset at the end of the day that nobody would buy wine. And I was like, these people aren't here to buy wine. They're here to have the experience and then go home. Like, they spent their $25 or their $30 or whatever on that experience. That was their intention. Their intention was never to buy the wine. So, I mean, if the wineries now are trying to reel in the millennials for that reason, I don't know that that's going to do anything, because not that I'm saying that the wineries where I was are all-knowing or whatever, but, like, I mean, we didn't see it work. They would just come in, do the tour, and then leave. So, I mean, maybe other people would know different, but I would say from my experience, we didn't. So
I just spent as Lori and Debbie know, I probably visit 3 to 5 wineries a week typically. So I'm spending a lot of time with the owners and the winemakers. And this last week, 2 weeks ago, I had the most interesting experience where I had two folks on very different, divergent paths on how to attract folks into their tasting room. One was going to the high-end escargot and champagne and food pairings at a very beautiful facility overlooking the vineyard, and it was gorgeous. But that's going to come at a price tag at $75 per person, and the wines run up to about $165. Okay, so he's really going after the baby boomers, the one percenters. And the other person I met with, very successful, I'm drinking her wine right now, as a matter of fact, who has now gone to open mic Wednesdays, bands on Thursday, happy hour, bands on Friday night, on and on and on. And I asked her flat out, we were just having breakfast at the coffee shop, and I said, do you really think you're selling more wines? Is this thing a break even? And she goes, my thought is that I'm actually making a little bit of money, but I'm giving them the experiences of having a good time at our tasting room with a band, with wine, with food from a catering truck that pulls up, kind of gourmet, but it's still a food truck. And now her place is absolutely jam-packed on Thursday and Friday and Saturday nights. And she doesn't seem to be she's doing almost 20,000 cases. And
now, a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracenaWines.com, and find out all of
of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank.
Going gangbusters.
Well, so I want to expand on that, Mike, about the winery experience that you talked about. And I want to add the wineries that are now serving local beers on tap and having local distilled spirits. It's like they don't feel that they can survive on their product alone. Mm-hmm. That they have to, cater to, the wine drinker that comes with the beer lover. I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and right across from where this person is located is the Altamont Brewing Company, literally across the street on a side street. So they can just walk back and forth. So half the people go over, have some beers, come over, get some food, have some wine. Yeah, they go back over, get a brew, and they're back and forth. And so I think that it's kind of like, rather than trying to fight the folks being, okay, you're a brewery and we're a winery and you're a hard liquor or seltzer, I think you could see down the road more of a combining of these guys and giving, and then that way exposing the millennials and the Gen X and Gen Ys to a greater opportunity for selection.
I think it's a great point. I agree almost 100% in as much as if you're creating a tasting room experience or a vineyard experience that's going to cost $100, and whether it's a great food pairing or some intricate segue tour through the vines, you're still going after that 1% as a customer. You're still going after that person who can afford a $100 tasting as part of their day in wine country. So, so you're not, you're creating a unique experience, but you haven't opened up your customer base at all. In fact, you might have just narrowed it. And, I think wineries have to take a page out of the drug dealer handbook and start offering more things for free. Come in and you get a tasting for free. And not only is it the way to get you hooked on what you're offering, but what you should pay for is data. It's massive customer data. Here's a free tasting, but in exchange, I want your name, your address, your phone number, your email. I want your social media handles. I want to know what you thought of these 10 wines. Rank them all for me. What did you like? And now you're creating a customer for life. Now you're creating this customer that you can approach with, through email or text or whatever their preferred form is, and try to get more sales down the line. I just think the whole paradigm of making it more costly and making it more experiential at cost is going to die.
Well, that
you can only go through so many wine. I mean, I gave up wine or vineyard tours 20 years ago. I mean, you've seen one vineyard, you've seen 1,000. I mean, it's not in 25 countries or something. A vineyard. Yeah, there's some different topography and there's different winds and blah blah blah. But a vineyard's a vineyard. Roses are roses. Grapes are grapes. Let's not get so enamored with it that it's everyone's terroir is exceptional, and we have the premium terroir for this grape and this to make this wine. The reality is the terroir is everywhere in the world, and everybody can make good grapes or good wines from various grapes all around the world. So don't think you have something. But that's what the wineries keep holding on to. This is that's their mantra. To hold on to that, to say we're unique because we have a very special terroir. Well, you're no more special than the next guy down the road. To be honest, I mean, Lori, no, I'm not stepping on your toes. I'm just trying to make a statement.
Yep. No, I understand. So John's comment of taking a page out of the book of the drug dealers is actually a great segue into the next cause of the downfall of wine is cannabis. So according to the Beverage Wine Enthusiast, they noted that cannabis demand, which skews the younger males, is likely having a limited substitution impact with young consumers. Today, there is a modest impact in the young drinking consumer with cannabis, but its use still carries a negative connotation socially. The big concern is that when it becomes taken off of the Schedule I drug list by the federal government, what then will really happen to the wine world? And it's kind of being led by Francis Ford Coppola, who out and out said that as soon as it's legal, he would be starting his own cannabis brand. So what do we think of...
Big stoner, that guy.
What?
It's a big stoner, that Francis Ford Coppola. Way back, old school.
So do we think cannabis is having an effect on drinking?
So the Harris poll that was recently given and why young consumers were reducing their consumption, this was the first week of January 2020. Mm-hmm. The number one reason they were opting they really wanted a healthier lifestyle, meaning that they were not even going after alcohol, let alone cannabis, because of whatever the reasons were. They lost interest in drinking alcohol in general, just 24%. The first one was 32% said healthier lifestyle, 24% drinking, no interest in drinking alcohol. So there you have 56% of the responses simply saying lifestyle or no alcohol. And then the other two major categories were 18% and 17% regarding health. And way down the list, at only 10%, had more interest in cannabis. Okay. So I think it's a gray herring, I guess, a red herring, that think to go after, that all these millennials are going after cannabis. I think it's an excuse, but I don't think that's, the reality hasn't really had a hard bite to it at this point.
Anybody else opinions on cannabis?
One of the things that I had heard was that the people that harvest grapes were being used to harvest cannabis instead. And so regarding the industry, that cannabis was having an effect on it because it was shifting people from the wine world to the cannabis world. But it was on the work side. It was like people are pulling out a vineyard, if you will, to plant cannabis instead. But as far as someone using cannabis and saying that they do that now instead of wine, that's not something I've heard about at all. So I don't know.
Well, I will say that cannabis does make it difficult on the business aspect of it. You know, the transient workers that harvest the fruit, you know, they're going to the cannabis farms because it's a full-time job. It's a year-round job because cannabis just keeps growing and growing and growing, where we're seasonal. So that does pose an issue. I personally don't think people are choosing cannabis over wine. I don't see that relationship. But what do you guys, John, Debbie?
Yeah, I would agree. I would consider it one of the choices, you know, you've got in your
arsenal
substance carousel, you know. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, until the federal government does destigmatize it and it is a nationwide thing and we've got, you know, 5-10 years behind that, it's going to be hard to tell whether it eats into alcohol consumption in general at all. I mean, it's almost like saying, do people smoke cigarettes or do they drink booze? You know, it's, well, you do both, or, you know, people have one or the other. It's not a conscious choice to make a decision of one to the other. I think that most people who smoke pot now that it's legal, smoke pot when it was illegal. You know, it's just what you did. So I think you have to sort of wait and see data about that as well to see how many people, now that it's legalized, how many people have said, okay, now I'm going to try that, and then have said, oh, now I'm going to try, I'm going to keep trying that, I'm going to keep using that, before you can really draw any kind of correlation between, you know, the increase in pot use and a decrease in alcohol use.
I think the people that are used to smoking pot are going to continue to smoke pot. I don't think, you know, unless, you know, when you start dealing with the whole cannabis wine, which is probably a whole other subject, you know, I think it's gonna stay wherever it is, you know.
I was trying to explain to a person at work, because they seem to think that I'm going to be their cannabis mule to New Jersey for them. They're like, oh, it's legal there, right? You can just like bring it. I'm like, no, I can't. Actually, they really wanted me to bring plants back. I'm like, oh yeah, let me just go on the plane with plants. But they were talking about how, you know, this is really going to affect everything because everybody's going to start getting stoned. And, my personal opinion is, like everybody has said, those who smoke were smoking already. It's just now legal. Right. And you're going to have a very small percentage of people who have been curious about what cannabis is, but have always been afraid to do something illegal. And then for a little bit, they're going to go and they're going to now buy the cannabis and they're going to try it. And of that small percentage that were afraid to be illegal, there's a smaller percentage that are going to say, oh, wow, this is pretty darn good, and then start smoking. I don't think we're going to have an entire society of stoned people because it's going to become legal. But I personally don't think that has an impact on why wine consumption is down at all.
I mean, you know what, also with wine consumption, I think there's just so many choices. You know, and cannabis is one of those choices.
Yep. There's also a lot of choices of cannabis out there.
Yeah.
I mean,
we've got your seltzer, your beer, your hard liquor, your cannabis, and then you have your cannabis wine.
I was going to say, maybe one of the things is that some could say that you get that relaxed effect from both of them, but like from cannabis and from wine, but I don't know. I don't see someone saying like, oh, I'm going to like have some cannabis with my dinner so that I get relaxed. I mean, like, really, like, they're not the same deal. So I don't see one being a replacement for the other. Like, I mean, a lot of people drink wine because they like wine and they like the flavor of it and they like that it pairs with their steak or their fish or whatever. I mean, like, I think that's why people drink wine. So I don't, yeah, maybe people could say, like, you get that same effect to some extent, but, like, I don't see one being the replacement for the other. They seem like different, I don't know, different activities, if you will.
I agree, and the people that enjoy cannabis, they're going to be sitting there smoking their pot. Ones that enjoy wine are going to be drinking their wine. Ones that enjoy their seltzer will be drinking their seltzer.
Okay. Well, you know, Maria, there are edibles, so maybe they will be putting them on their plate next to their mashed potatoes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, very well could be, but I mean, I don't know. Like I said, just clearly from the point of them being a beverage or whatever. Right. I mean,
yeah, I think that you're they are comparing apples to oranges there. Just as they want to blame millennials for everything, I think they want to blame cannabis for everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it is the gateway to every other drug on the face of the earth. Okay. So apparently, now I don't know if this is what you were referring to, Michael, but apparently the biggest report of predictions and in the wine industry is usually done by Rob McMillan, EVP and founder of the Silicon Valley Bank's wine division. I honestly have never heard of this before, the Silicon Valley Bank's wine division. First of all, a bank has a wine division that, unless I'm like taking that literally,
let me give you a little background. So Silicon Valley Bank is a major banking operation in Silicon Valley that and I've been involved with them for 20 years plus, and they are involved with financing and taking companies out of IPOs and making them public, et cetera, et cetera. And they have done that with two companies I've been involved with. And they are very large. And then they've also, Rob McMillan, who I've been on the broadcast for them for 5 years. And there was another one this morning. There was part two of the broadcast this morning. There's part one was a couple of weeks ago. Part two was today. They go, so Rob is up in St. Helena, and what he does is he goes around and talks with everybody. He also, I think today he said he was involved with 51 or 61 wineries who are their clients. So they are involved in actually funding and financing the various wineries up in Napa with mortgages and capital improvements, et cetera, et cetera. Does that help a little bit?
Yes. Yes. I was kind of stupid. I guess that makes sense. I'm thinking they have their own wine, you know, but yes, makes sense that a bank would invest in vineyards.
Investing.
And every year, Rob McMillan sends out this incredibly detailed questionnaire to vintners and industry workers, especially people in DTC, and ask them, you know, in anonymously to answer upwards of 100 questions about how the business is going. And so he compiles all those answers and comes out with these very detailed reports. And to some of us, it is the Bible. It is excellent, excellent data.
Yeah. And Rob is a very interesting character. You can meet with him, and I've had lots of correspondence with him over during the course of the year, not just during these podcast opportunities. And he's kind of detached from the wine industry, but he's kind of a spokesperson for the industry. But he's a little detached because he's not somebody who's just trying to understand it as a whole. He's not advocating a position or has got an axe to grind, except for he just wants his bank to make money, bottom line.
So I pulled out three, and I did not read that whole report because that was insane. Insane in a good way. But I pulled out, it was a lot. I pulled out three points that he came across. And anybody who was interested in seeing this big report, it is svb.com/wine-report. So nice and simple. He does what they got right and what they got wrong. That was like kind of the section I was focusing in on. And they thought imports would gain market share at the expense of domestic production. And through October, there was no change in the import share versus the domestic. So basically, they thought that imports would be taking over more of the consumption or purchasing, and domestic is still leading that. Their prediction was to predict a sales value growth range between 3% and 7% for the premium wine segment, and that was down about 1% from the 2019 sales growth estimate. For the off-premise retail store channel, value will fall between a negative 2% and 0%, and the overall volume is going to fall in a range between negative 1 and negative 3. So he's predicting on average a 2% drop within 2020. And then his final thing that I pulled out was retiring baby boomers seem to have a long tail and fortunately aren't quick to run to pasture. They continue to buy wine at all price points, but their buying seems to be moderating both on price and volume as they age, which is basically what John was saying earlier. So those were the three points that he was mentioning, or that I pulled out, I should say.
It's a great report. And if you really want to walk out sometime, read the whole thing, because there's fascinating insights, especially if you follow it year after year after year. And you can sort of see, you know, what they got right in their predictions and what they got wrong, and you know how the industry really did trend. But it is a fountain of information.
So my last thing that I have is also off of his report, and I just thought this was an interesting statistic of age versus consumption, and see if you guys agree with it. It says millennials. Oh, see, here it says between 23 and 38, And Gen Z populations, who are 21 and 22, represent 34% of all populations, 20 years old and older. However, they are only 19% of all wine consumers, according to the Silicon. Say that. What, Deb?
I can believe that, but go ahead.
According to the Silicon Valley Bank's industry survey, boomers represent 40% of all wine drinkers, but as they age, their wine consumption is decreasing dramatically. Mature consumers in their 70s only represent 6% of all wine drinkers. The larger numbers are drinking less.
I think that the baby boomer part is because their income is decreasing. What they once were able to afford, they can't now, you know, for whatever reasons. That, you know, where I think that segment's going, and the, I don't know, whatever the generations are afterwards are not picking up the scope on the wine and the purchasing and the quality. And
so some of the baby boomers in the community that I live in here, which is not a retirement community, but there's a lot of baby boomers in the community, they're not even participating in wine, not for the any reason other than that they're getting older after the group 70 and 75, and they're on medication that doesn't allow them to have any alcohol, period. You know, I have a neighbor on one side who's got 75, and he just can't really have any alcohol because of medication he's on.
That's true too. That's another factor. Yeah, definitely. I've heard family members say that to me. Oh, well, I can't drink alcohol anymore. So yeah, I would say that probably is a big part of it, whether it has to do with wanting to or not wanting to. They just don't because it conflicts with their medicine.
I didn't think about that, but yeah, that's true. That is true. Of course, I have never listened to when it says do not drink when you're on this medication. but, oh, well, I'm ready to gamble that dice. Here we go. All right. So we are at the hour mark. Basically, does anybody have any other thoughts on the wine consumption drop? Do we think this is a fad? Do we think this is going to continue? Is this the end-all, be-all of wine? Are we all doomed to not have wine anymore in our lives, or what?
I think just like everything else, it's a vicious circle, and it will come around.
John, final thoughts on that?
Yeah, I could agree with that. I think it's going to be cyclical, and I think some really fundamental things are going to have to change for that cycle to come back up. I think that the high priced wine and the high priced wineries are a unsustainable model. It just can't go on. It's a bubble that's going to burst.
Okay, Michael.
Yeah.
Well. So I guess I don't take the attitude that it's a cycle. I think, you know, I wrote that article, Chaos or Time for Reinvention, and I think that as my CEOs of various companies that I worked for and I was responsible for bottom line revenue for billions of dollars, I say, I hope this quarter we're going to make our number. You know, they said, hope is not a strategy. You know, so to hope that it's going to come around a circle or a cycle, I think there's going to be a significant reawakening, reinvention of how this industry survives, whether it's by price or by reaching out to the right people. Today with Rob McMillan, I sent a note to him saying, hey, what happened to, you know, Denny's has the senior discount, you know, breakfast, you know, slam bam, you know, eggs and bacon. Where's the wineries who... You know, I was a member for wineries for 12 years, getting $100 bottles and buying 24 bottles a year, $2,400 a year. Well, at some point, maybe the wineries could pull back and say, you're not responsible for that much quantity or that much volume, but we'll let you slide by with six bottles, but we'll still give you the good price. So I think that's one of the suggestions I made today, was that they need to address the baby boomers in a model that makes sense, as well as still drawing in the millennials and the X gen and the Y gen and everything else, because the baby boomers, to your point earlier, had 40% of this discretionary, the bigger basket. Don't be so greedy to capture all the basket that's going away. Capture some of that basket.
Well, just to say, that's one of the reasons why Dracena Wines, we only do 6 bottles a year, and you get a discount that increases every year you're with us. Just saying.
Remember, you won all these double gold medals recently.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that, like John was saying, that the high-priced wineries and the high-priced wines aren't sustainable. I mean, I 100% agree with that. I've never even been to a lot of the Napa wineries for that exact reason. I mean, if it's $70 for a tasting, I just say forget it. It's not worth it. I can go somewhere in Sonoma or Lake County or any of the other ones that aren't as big a deal as Napa, and you get just as good wine for $20 tastings or $30 tastings. I mean, those high ticket ones, to me, they're not what I look for. But I think it will be interesting just to see in the future. I mean, what happens? I mean, you never, I don't know. Things are hard to predict. You kind of just have to wait and see, I think. So.
Okay. I think that a lot of these wineries that are these, you know, they're building these amazing villas to give this appearance, you know, that's all marble and all of this stuff. I agree. Eventually that bubble is going to burst. And a $70 tasting, I'm not going to a place for a $70 tasting, to give a taste of wine. And then some of these wineries, you know, some wineries at least, you know, there's the tasting fee, but if you buy a bottle, the tasting fee is waived. Okay, now you start to, you know, weigh the value. Well, I just paid, you know, $20 for a tasting fee, but the bottle is $30, so I'm getting a bottle for $10, basically. All right, that I get. But some of these wineries aren't even doing that. It's $70, and that's it. And I think you're right. It's going to – people aren't going to continue to do that. But like you said, Maria, it's a prediction. I don't know. Maybe it'll go up to $150 tasting. People are going to start doing it. You know, there's a lot of things out there that people pay for that I'm like, whoa, I'd never do that. So, all right. Ready for the riddle?
Look at this.
Yeah.
Yay. Okay. I have keys, but no locks. I have space, but no rooms. You can enter, but you can't go outside. What am I?
But no locks.
What did you say, Deb?
No, I'm just repeating what you said.
Oh. Okay.
No locks.
I have keys, but no locks. I have space, but no rooms. You can enter, but you can't go outside. What am I?
A keyboard.
A keyboard, very good. Maria is good at these.
Wow.
Very, very good. Very good. A keyboard. Yay. I think Maria is like kicking butt in the riddle game there. She gets a lot of them. So fake trophy for you. Here you go.
Thank you.
All right, so let's give you one last minute each to tell people what's going on in your lives, what you want them to know, or where they can find you and all of that good stuff. So Maria, well, let's start with you.
All right, great. Well, I mentioned we're Wine and Cheese Friday, and our Twitter handle is @WineCheeseFry, and that's the same thing for our Instagram handle, @WineCheeseFry. We have a Facebook fan page too, and I just bought a case of wine that included Chilean, Peruvian, and Argentinian wines that I got yesterday. So nice. That's what's on my docket for now.
Awesome. Awesome. Michael, how about you?
Best way to get to me is on my website, https://CaliforniaWinesAndWineries.com. I do blogs and had the distinct privilege of hosting for the first time the California Wines and Wineries Cab Franc wine competition, which a plug for Lori, they and Michael, they won the professional judges best of show, best of class, and double gold medals. So, and it was wine tasting, and nobody knew anybody from it. And all the judges, interestingly enough, were from Lodi, Napa, Sierra, and the Sierras. So they were not, Paso was not in their wheelhouse or their palate profile, and yet Paso won. I think that's a great, it says two things. The judges were very fair and objective, and Lori and Michael make very good wine. So that's.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Congratulations.
Thanks, John. Thank you. And what about you, John?
So lots of things brewing, so I don't want to jinx anything right now, but yeah, we'll see. So, but in the meantime, you can always check out my blog site at pairswithlife.net, and you can follow on Instagram and Twitter at JATAuthor. So, yeah, but do keep your fingers crossed. So.
Okay, they're crossed for you. Debbie?
Debbie G. Quina, you can follow me at HudsonValleyWineGoddess.com. I'm HB Wine Goddess on Twitter and Facebook, and Hudson Valley Wine Goddess on Hudson Valley Wine Goddess on Facebook. Lori and I do the program on WineForBedStreet.com, and my book is available on Amazon, Tapping the Hudson Valley, and the restaurant Kitchen 330 is opening again for the season April 3rd in Stone Harbor, New Jersey.
Okay.
Awesome.
And again, I am Lori, your host, and I am insane with two of everything. I don't know why I did that, but two of everything. So you can find me all over the socials for the winery under Dracena Wines, and all for the blog and the podcast under Exploring the Wine Glass, except on Twitter that was too many letters. So it's just Explore Wine Glass without the E. So thank you everybody for joining and taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk about this. And please, if you have any topics that you would like to bring up for future Wine Writers Wrap Up, please let me know, because I am always looking for topics for fun conversations for us to get into. So thank you very much. And we didn't do a cheers or a toast. I'm drinking water, but cheers,
right.
Sláinte. Have a great night. Have a great night, everybody. Thank you so much for joining.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, Sláinte.